Hi, this is Sahil. I work at Instacart as a machine learning engineer, where we are developing a centralized platform to support training, deployment, and managing different ML applications. This might be controversial, but if you don't drink coffee, I love green tea. Actually, this happened. Like, once I gave my first interview, and someone mentioned that you don't drink coffee, you are not a software engineer. Okay.
Mike, dude, thanks to you, I got a funny looking mustache.
Love it. Tell everybody why you got the mustache.
So, last week, I was in Spain and I was hosting the Apply conference, but I couldn't host it at the Airbnb because my wife and daughter are there. And so I ended up going to my buddy's place, which is a barbershop. And I figured, well, you know what? Since I'm here hosting the Apply conference, I might as well get a haircut and a shave while I'm at it. So I killed two birds with one stone and I managed to come out with this funny looking mustache.
Future podcast participants, that should be a requirement as well.
I kind of just was a fly on the wall letting you guys chat because it was super cool to see your experience at Uber and what he's been doing at Instacart and how much overlap there was and how many different ways you both went about things, but then there was that, like, you come back to the same learnings almost. What were some key takeaways from your side?
I mean, I think these guys are doing it right. And Sahil's super smart, and I love that he's a super humble guy, just explaining, like, hey, this is the problems we had and this is how we solved it. The patterns that they've put together are the same kind of patterns that we're seeing kind of like the industry converge on. Some people build stuff in-house, some people like buy solutions for like more or less parts of it. But like he talked a lot about this journey from going from, hey, we were all batch to we were partly batch and sometimes a little bit of real time, and then kind of went to like the full real time. And they had a really good idea of like internal motivation of why should we go real time, and they did all the right things of starting simple and easing into something without just building some super complicated thing from the beginning that would invariably end up being the wrong thing at the end of the day. Yeah. And so I really like kind of the journey that they went through seems like a pretty relevant journey for ML team that may be listening to this. I think one of the kind of interesting assumptions that is super relevant for, obviously true for Instacart, that I think is increasingly true for most businesses, is that real time is important. And Instacart, it was obvious to them early on. And I think just from the conversations we're having in MLOps community and beyond, I think a lot more people are starting to get to the point where, okay, our batch ML story like is pretty straightforward now. How do we make our recommenders personalized in real time? How do we detect fraud in real time? And the Instacart guys have in their blog posts like 12 plus different use cases that they can point to that have been improved by going real time. And so it's a really interesting case study of the value of that.
Yeah, for anybody that has not read both of their blog posts, one is how they put like 3x, I think like 1,000 models into production at Instacart. And then the other one is going real time and the journey of going real time. Both of those are highly recommended. Some of the best reads that you can find over this last year in the MLOps space. And Sahil is one of the culprits behind both of those blogs. So it was super cool to hear his story. One thing that I loved that I will just say was awesome is how he said, you know what? If you need to get something proven to the greater organization, get it up and running with batch as fast as you can, and then you can go and figure out how to make those steps towards real time. Because he's like, this use case needs to at least have some kind of data behind it that it's worthy of pursuing. So let's just get it up, let's deploy it, let's do what we can, and then we can go and we can figure out like that real time. And it's very much like what you're saying.
Yeah, I think there's just generally different factors that affect their success. There's hard factors like we chose the wrong technology or we chose the wrong problem. And then there's soft factors like we just kind of had the wrong approach about being customer focused, or we had the right approach about that, or we focused on scale at this stage versus this stage kind of thing. And I would say in this conversation, you can repeatedly had a lot of, it's not even super obvious when he's not even making a point really. He's just saying like, here are some things that we did But the soft factors, in addition to the hard factors, the soft factors, he just got right repeatedly. It's like a lot of wisdom were kind of like bundled into the stuff he's saying. For example, one of the things he said was, early on, we stayed super customer focused. We just helped every one of our customers one-on-one, like we did pair programming. And then we got to a point where for our platform team, it didn't make sense to do that anymore. And we intentionally switched to effectively like changing how we work with that kind of intentional for an internal platform team. Honestly, it's like a little bit more rare than it should be. And I think that's really needed to make for a very successful platform. So, you know, two thumbs up on their journey. These guys are, they know what they're doing. And it's a really good case study for everybody.
Exactly. So enjoy it. We're going to get right into it. Thank you, Mike. I got to give you a huge shout out because Tekton has been an incredible sponsor of the MLOps community. So anybody looking to go real time, check out Tekton.
For sure. Check us out. And we talk a lot about like batch streaming and real time features in this conversation. And that's something that we specialize in at Tekton. So if you're doing any real time stuff, check us out and
there
come
you
chat
go.
With us. I'll hop on a call with you.
And if you're looking to get more in the MLOps community, we've got a newsletter that you should probably subscribe to if you're not already. And we also are in over 30 cities around the world, from Melbourne, Australia, to Tel Aviv, to Berlin, to San Francisco, to New York, Chicago, you name it. We are everywhere. Even, Mike, your hometown, we got one in Toronto, man.
Right now, right on, man. I'll be there.
there we go.
Let me know when we're doing a meetup there. I'll fly out.
We do it outside in the winter on a frozen lake, actually, and people play hockey. And then they give presentation. There's all kinds of cool meetups happening. We will see you on the other side. Enjoy this conversation.
Cool. Cheers. Enjoy it.
We're going to get to talking about Instacart and what y'all have been doing, Sahil, because it is incredible. I remember when the blog post came out, I couldn't stop sharing it. I really appreciate the transparency you all put into talking about your journey from this batch prediction style to real time. And considering all the hype that real time gets, I thought it was only perfect for us to talk about that. And maybe you can just explain to us, like you told me before we started recording, how much things have changed and how you have to iterate quickly and you have to really stay in touch with your users. But let's start from the beginning when you were just serving things in this batch style. What did that look like and where were the pains?
Yeah, So our team is very new at Instacart. Like it started 2 years ago. So at that time, the simplest thing any machine learning engineers can do as a first step is to train a model, deploy it in a batch mode so that they don't have to manage any production critical application. So they used to do that a lot. And we used to have our own centralized catalog store. So they used to like create all these batch inference predictions, just put it in the catalog store. And then catalog store will handle all the joins, all the filtering, all the candidate generation and stuff like that, which was easiest thing to do at that time. But it has limitations, right? Like you can't do a lot with batch because the data is stale. Your model doesn't get any real-time session context. Even like the simplest things, like you can't refresh the data on a very regular cadence because you have to like wait for the whole batch inference job complete. And then batch inference job also, you can't predict all the items or score for every single thing. We have like, I think world's biggest catalog, I believe like it's billions of items. So you can't, the cardinality is huge. So you can't predict scores for every single item. So that there were a lot of challenges, which also were visible on the products because the experience was not great because of this limitation.
One of the things that I find is tricky for people who are working on MLOps related stuff is that there's a lot of good advice out there, but it's always hard to determine because like most people are new to MLOps and then they're trying to figure out like, hey, how relevant is this thing for me? Yeah. Like, is this a thing that I should know how to do? Or is this a thing that's like in my situation, not even relevant for me because there's no chance I could build this kind of thing, or like this problem domain is whatever, the solution is relevant for a problem domain where they have 1 million x the amount of data or something like that. And so Do you mind just kind of giving some like high level, like what kind of problem do we have here? Like, what's the data look like? What's the infrastructure? What's the internal team? Like, is it an ML platform team? And what are the use cases? Just kind of some of the high level stuff to help people kind of triangulate, like, what was your context when taking this on?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Especially, like, this is something which is very interesting to me for Instacart. Like, Instacart, we have, like, all the ML application I know except the audio for signal processing. Like, we do computer vision, we do recommendation, ranking, ads, logistics, like, all the domain, because it has from store to the website, like, we manage all the applications, which is a lot of different problems we are trying to solve, and it requires a lot of different tools and frameworks, which is also a very biggest challenge for us. So that's the lay of land there.
It sounds pretty similar to what we did at Uber, actually. Like, all the same use cases.
Yeah, so that provides complexity in terms of how we will support these different use cases, which are different requirements, and team has different ways to handle it. And because Instacart is a very fast-growing company, right? We are wants to launch a lot of things very quickly to try it out, just to see whether it works or not. Like, we don't want to, like, wait for 6 months to build something and then see whether this is the right solution for our problem or not. So because of this pace, we have to create a lot of flexibility in our tools starting so that people can go release something to batch quickly, try it out. If things make sense, then do a further iteration to improve their products. So that's the start of how we started building a lot of ML infrastructure related.
And what is your team? Are you the centralized ML platform team?
Yes. So that's also, the organization structure is a little different. We are trying to create a centralized machine learning platform, but our organization structure is tied to different orgs. So it doesn't mean that we will only cater to that org. So when we started, our vision was to create a centralized platform so that we can support all the organization at Instacart involved, including the data scientists and product teams. So that's our vision. It didn't start like that. We started with one organization, so we built a lot of tools to cater to that organization. But because we were the only team who were focusing on building these tools, so we tried to now expand our tool set to different organizations. So now we are working on, from tools to platform, we are going to build, and like, we are going in that direction. We're building a centralized platform.
Yeah, I think I've seen, like, so we talked to a lot of ML platform teams, and I think there's kind of roughly two types of ML platform teams, or like stories of the birth of an ML platform team. One is maybe what you're describing, where it's kind of like, there's one business case, right? Say, like, one product use case, like, I'm just going to choose a random one, fraud detection, where the fraud detection team, maybe have a couple models, so they start, like, kind of centralizing some of their tech, and then it becomes a little bit of, like, a fraud detection ML platform. And then the other team, like, the recommender team is like, hey, can we use some of that? And it kind of, this platform kind of organically comes out from, like, rooted in concrete use cases, and slowly generalizes over time, and then can become maybe the company-wide ML platform. And then the second kind of like a genesis story I see for ML platforms is the kind of like, hey, we had a bunch of like ML use cases across the projects across the company. And then from the chief data officer or whatever, the top down, they said, build an ML, centralized ML team. And probably someone made the big pitch to do that. And then they're just tasked with like starting from zero, a greenfield project. And it sounds like you're more like, your story is more the former. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's interesting. And part of the nice things about that is that you always have very concrete requirements. You have a much lower risk of building stuff that nobody cares about, right? If you're kind of starting as this platform, generic platform team, you're just trying to like help out everybody, you have to win the buy-in from those other teams in the first place. Sure. And they're probably doing their own thing. And so you kind of build on your own before you can convince them to use your system. But you were kind of like you always had some concrete customers on your platform from the beginning then.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. That's true. Initially, because there wasn't any tools which can cater to a lot of feature requests users had. So we were the only team who were catering to it. So we always had a user or an application which will use the feature instantaneously and it's released. But now because we are now building this centralized platform, we are going into that direction where we have to collaborate with the node organization, find alignments, figure out what feature makes sense to release, decide priorities. So there has been a lot of changes in the processes. Like I think I was mentioning, like we used to do like a lot of one-on-one session, pre-programming, code labs with users. That was great initially, but that doesn't scale. So now we are changing processes where we have like centralized consoles, we have meetings where we hear like customer voice so that we can get more requirements which show and tell our features which we have built during the time period. So that's the shift is happening in that process is because that's, I think, needed right now to figure out.
Well, you mentioned before that you had done something where you went off and you built some feature or some tool, and then you came back and you realized that the needs had changed and it wasn't useful anymore. Can you tell us about that story?
Yeah, that was an experience I learned from my previous work. So we, like initially when we do planning, we get all the requirements from users. We plan, we design the architecture of a system, and then we go into the implementation phase. The mistake we did by, like, we didn't do incremental planning, which means like we didn't plan the deliverables based on the milestones so that we can keep getting the feedback from users, see whether the needs are same, whether it's changing or not. So we went into the implementation rabbit hole. We deliver something after 6 months and realize things change. Users don't need this anymore. Or the actual users change. They are like more advanced. They want more control and stuff like that. And that was a learning I learned from a previous experience with it. Like, machine learning is a very, very dynamic field. Like you can't plan for 6 months. You have to plan for months, like quarters. That's the cycle we do right now.
Hey, Laszlo here. If you're serious about MLOps, you hit subscribe right now.
It's a really interesting journey going from this scale where you have a manageable number of internal customers where you can provide them one-on-one or unscalable support and kind of like success help to going to this thing, to this a scale where you can't do that. And so you got to figure out how to have your internal product be able to allow the internal customer to become self-sufficient with your platform. And so what are some of the things you learned in that journey?
Yeah, I think self-serviceable is like our main development principle. Like anytime we build something, we try to make it self-serviceable. To start with, we create these documents, like guides, create code labs so that people can actually play with it and see how things work with a simple example. And now we are also changing that kind of interface where instead of having a lot of guides, document processes, we are trying to build this centralized unified web application and the front end UI so that the UI can direct users how to use this platform, like what's the recommended way, where you should start. So that's a shift is also happening in our tool sets as we're having set of libraries or set of things people can use to go to this web page, start here, and then from there you will get to the next step, and then in the end you can deploy your training workflow. So we are trying to build and go UIF based, which is also kind of a user experience we want to provide to data scientists, especially like machine learning engineers are still in our company, are used to set up their local environment, run things, test things, but data scientists are currently only working on notebooks. So for them, it's a very big steep learning curve from going from notebooks to like putting some code in some place, waiting for PR builds to run or live unit test and things like that.
I was going to ask exactly about who your internal customers are as well, because when we talk to different ML platform teams, sometimes their customers are engineers, sometimes they're data scientists who are great at writing Python code, but not great at managing production stuff. Or sometimes it's kind of just like an internal analyst kind of person who doesn't want to write any code at all. And it sounds like you guys kind of spike with that middle bucket of data scientists who live in the Jupyter Notebook world. And so you're building for that set of workflows?
Yes, because we have reached a scale where we can cater to machine learning engineers, which were our direct users. Then machine learning engineers used to work with data scientists. Now, in order to grow a scale ML at Instacart, we want to provide data scientists direct user interface, which they can use and then go and deploy their own machine learning models and integrate more features into the products.
So
one thing.
Sorry, let me just ask one more question here, because I think this is just like a super interesting journey here. So it sounds like you started with ML engineers. You were like, hey, the first people we're going to make this work for is the super technical people and the customer teams. And then naturally it's like, hey, my data scientist wants to use this thing too. The data scientist began supporting the data scientists, but that was teams that had MLEs and data scientists. So they had like some engineer who could kind of like help maintain this thing in production. And now you're transitioning, this is the most interesting part for me. Now you're transitioning even away from requiring the engineering persona at all. So you can support, you can tell me if I'm getting this right, but it sounds like you can support a data scientist who can, without any engineering help, maintain a production ML application. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Like rather than them maintaining, we are going towards a standardized platform where we have our own standardized runtimes, our own things. So
right.
Data scientist needs to just configure their workflow. Like these are the features I need. This is a training parameter. Click a submit button and then all the management will happen through our platform, and then we will manage the production models and services.
And they still have, great, and this is quite similar to what we did with Michelangelo at Uber, but we always had an engineer, like let's say you're doing the estimated time of arrival stuff, right? Then on the customer team, we always still had some engineering person plug into those predictions and integrate it into the front end of the product and stuff. And I assume that's what you guys have as well, right?
Yes, so we have our own backend engineers for all products, so they help integrate models into the products. Yes.
And so this is Griffin that you're talking about, right? This is the machine learning platform?
Yes, this is Griffin.
Yeah, and so in the blog post that you wrote about going from this basically batch to real time, you spoke about three different stages. And for me, I looked at it as like there was batch, and then there was like this bridge stage where you were trying to get off batch, and then there was actually real time. And you told me earlier that one of the things that you're very proud about is the architecture design that you chose for Griffin. Can you speak a little bit to how that like became what it was? Like, how did that manifest into the world, and how did you decide on these different choices?
Yeah, one thing I mentioned like in previously is that our users required a lot of flexibility initially, because we were a very new team. We didn't know the requirements. We wanted to gather the requirements, so we wanted to provide flexibility. I mean, providing flexibility from platform team is a scary thing, because it leads to a lot of support requests, technical debt, or problem in maintaining things in production. In order to ensure that we can still provide flexibility and scale and extend our platform to be more standardized, we introduced three different layers. Like one was we decided on using Docker reusable component, so that every time we do local development, we do it in Docker. We provided command line tools to deploy those Dockers on a remote environment, and people can reliably build their applications, test their application from local to production. We can ensure that all the environment setup around and their development and production will be consistent. So that's one thing we did. We started with a unified interface, which I mentioned, like the command line tool, so that we know the entry point for user, and then we can change things around it so that we can slowly migrate to this standard things. Like one example I would give here is we might have a custom application for Docker. Now we can use standard application for Docker behind the scene. A user don't need to do a lot of changes in their workflow. And then from there, because we were like small teams, we didn't have a lot of resources to build a lot of things. We wanted to buy a lot of technologies or use open source tools, which was already out there, which can fulfill any. So in order to use those tools and still be flexible to like change and remove things, so we built this sensible abstraction layer so that we can easily plug in any technology with a consistent API and then replace that technology behind the scene with different technology when the requirement changes with time. So this whole three like principles help us build a lot of tools around it, which we gradually scaled. Like we changed a lot of technology. For example, we built feature store, started with Redis, then Ghost became an issue. We started introducing more disk-based database solutions behind the scene. For workflow manager, like we started with Airflow, we started with SageMaker. Now we are moving from Airflow, SageMaker to like Ray or Kubeflow pipe. So all these things we could do because we had this abstraction layers in front of it, which ensures that we have a consistent interface for users and users don't need to like change a lot of things when we move the technology behind the scene. And so, yeah, that three things really helped us where we released something quickly, which was easily available. And now we are re-evaluating and changing technologies behind the scenes to scale.
And sorry, can you just summarize the three things? It sounded like local, like using Docker, local remote development is consistent, and then clean interfaces?
Yeah, so reusable Docker-based components, right, interface, and then extensible abstractions.
Got it. And one thing that's really interesting, and I've seen those principles be really useful beyond Instacart, so it seems like that's like just general really great practices. On the local and remote consistent development, what sometimes we see, a lot of people have this kind of situation where the local environment is not representative of the production environment. And so when they're writing their code, even if they're using the same Docker containers and stuff like that, they either don't have access to the production systems or like it's just like a kind of a mess to run this thing locally. And particularly in the feature platform, feature store world that I spend a lot of time on as well, that's one of the challenges that we intend to solve for the data flows, at least. What are some of the kind of challenges that your team had for managing the online and offline, or we can even think of it as dev, prod, environment, consistency? What are some of the things you dealt with and how did you address them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we use AWS very heavily, and like for us, dev and prod is different accounts, which has its own restrictions because it has its own resources and network pairing and stuff like that. So in order for us to like ensure we can have same environment, so we allow only do development in the dev account. We don't allow users to do any development in production. So all the configuration which we use to the remote machine, we mount the same configuration when they run things locally, which ensures that they have same access to the AWS credential, they have same environment configuration they need to run things locally. And all the dev resources are accessible from their local environment as well. So they can run, they can integrate, and they can test things. In order to go from dev to prod, there are different strategies we chose. Like but the most important one for like feature store related pipelines, the way we do that is when people run a dev pipeline and it's successful and it registers all the features to dev, we in our platform transition that pipeline to production rather than users deploying a new pipeline to production.
Right.
So like our dev pipeline success is for us a signal saying this pipeline works with all the tool sets we have and it's computing the features reliably, we can transition now that pipeline from dev to production. So that's something which we use in order to transitions accounts or states for features. For other things, the workflow is a little bit different. For example, for model training and storing, we don't want people to deploy dev models to production. Like we have our own process, so then they release a code to masters to make sure things are reproducible, and then they follow that process to productionize any service or a model. But for
so
features,
you manage, like any model that goes to production, it's actually your system that manages the training of that model and then the promotion to production.
Yes.
So your customer user, whatever, would not ever build a model in some way that you guys don't need to know about and then just give you a model and then you serve it.
So one thing we try to do is we try to standardize the interfaces between different products. So for them to use like model serving platform we have, they have to package their model with our SDK so that we can reliably deploy that model to serve. And then in order to test that deployment, we have like stepwise deployment where we deploy to dev first, run some sort of integration test to make sure it meets all the SLAs. Then we deploy to production with like a canary deployment so that we can roll back anytime there's an issue. So that's how we try to make it reliable. But we do support users creating their custom models and applications. The only thing is they have to use that boundary interfaces which we have created in order to integrate with our
platform. They're kind of a little bit more on their own and there's less promises that come with that and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then going back to the kind of feature management point, so you said, hey, we have a way for people to author feature pipelines in the dev world. And then I think you said, we don't, or maybe I got this wrong, but I think you said, we don't ask them to rebuild a new feature pipeline. You upgrade it or promote it to production for them so they don't have to rebuild it in production?
Yes. So all the feature pipeline in dev, they computes feature based on some query or something and then store data in a dev environment. Then once the pipeline is working fine, we just export that data to production saying this feature is productionized. Now it's immutable. You can't change it.
You export the computed data to production?
No, like the pipeline.
Oh, the
we
pipeline.
Export
okay.
The pipeline so that we compute every day in production. But the moment we do that transition, we make the whole pipeline immutable so that people can't change any of the logic.
Cool. And one challenge that I've seen other teams deal with in that same, when they try to do what you're doing, and often it's unsuccessful, is the data sources that are available to a production or to the dev environment and the production environment are different. And so it's hard for them to actually take that same data pipeline and just promote it. What are the details of that for you? Is that not a challenge for you guys?
We have a centralized warehouse. Like we currently use Snowflake, so it's accessible. All the data sources are accessible to both the environments. And then we have our real-time pipeline running on Kafka, which is also accessible to both the environments. So
okay.
For us, because we have a centralized storage for this data, so it's not a big challenge. But like all the isolation happens on the compute level, not at the storage level.
Got it. Cool. And so maybe we can talk through some of the stages that you went through to adopt more and more real-time ML. And maybe we can just start with like understanding why you even did that. Like why was real-time important and how did you know it was important?
Yeah. So I was saying like batch inference was good for us to test things very quickly, right? Then we moved to, there was this bridge which we mentioned, like going to online service. So that was useful for us to create this feature for infrastructure. Plus it was useful for us to handle those tail queries which we couldn't compute during batch. So that was an upgrade from batch. And then we introduced a production critical system. So the next upgrade was, now we are using all the batch features in our feature store, which are computing every day or every week. Now let's introduce more real-time features, which are computed every minute or every few minutes.
And before doing that, though, how did you know that would, like, because going to real-time features, that's a big effort. And so was it obvious that would be worth it? Or were you like, hey, let's try this, but it's a big guess?
Yeah, that's a good one. Like, I think the reason we tried for the first application where we wanted to do personalized recommendation, and we could only do personalized recommendation if we start reading a lot of user session information. So that was the first use case. So we tried with that use case where we built some user-specific features so that we can recommend products which are more preferable to that particular user based on their history during that session. That was the first use case. Like we wanted to test the use case and we had a hypothesis that this will provide a benefit. So that's how it started. So once we had a success with one use case, then we build like the whole group around real-time features where it had a representation from machine learning engineers, the infrastructure engineers from both data platform and machine learning platform. And then that group will decide like which is the next set of features they want to launch and what are the applications which can benefit from them. So that's how it started. Like, now we are in a stage where we want to make it like self-serviceable so that people can just go and deploy their real-time pipelines and compute features without worrying about a lot of infrastructure-related stuff.
And do you guys have this concept for real-time, when we say real-time features, in the TechCon Feast world, we talk about batch computed features, streaming, aggregation features, and then actual real-time features. We call them on-demand features, which use something that comes from, say, like a search query or something that's only available at prediction time. Do you have all three of those, or do you classify things in a different way?
So that's a good question. So in the second stage, we could actually use the batch plus the real-time in Tecton world, where we could send context in a request, which is only available at the backend at that time. So that's the introduction in the second stage, where we could now use the context of the request to do like better prediction. And yep. Then the third stage was like the streaming aggregate features, which require us to like aggregate a set of time and like events in some time frame so that we can compute some information from it. So yeah, so that there were three stages. So the second stage was useful because first we could handle TF queries, and then we can also introduce context based in the backend, available in the backend.
Very cool. Dee, what were you going to say?
I was thinking about how now you're trying to move more towards this self-serve motion, and I'm wondering what other things you have on your mind. You went from batch to streaming. What does the future look like? What are some things that you're trying to accomplish in the next couple quarters?
Yeah, so right now we are moving towards this centralized platform. Like, we had a lot of tools and libraries and systems in order to provide these abilities, but now we are building this centralized platform. And our vision is that user will go on this platform where in the first page they can define what feature they want to use. Whether if it exists, they can just use those features. If it doesn't exist, they can submit a job from the UI to compute those features. And then they can move to the next step where they can train the model, they can publish the model, and then they can deploy the model to production. So we are building this web application which will have all this API so that we can standardize a lot of management around how to train a model, how to deploy a model, how to compute features, how to deploy feature pipelines, and do alerts and stuff like that in the platform. So that's where we are going. So all our tools are working for customized application where users can go and write some code and deploy things. Now we are moving towards providing standard application where user will go and provide some configuration rather than code, and then we will deploy that configuration to our standard code to compute things.
Really, really interesting. And maybe one other topic that may be interesting to dig into is just what is the reason to do real-time or streaming features? And so what I'm getting at is like, probably it's because there's a different kind of data, different kind of signal, different kind of information that you are able to make available to the model. And I heard you talk about like session, you mentioned sessions. And so what I'm seeing increasingly, people are really trying to featureize sessions. So find some way in real time to say, hey, based on a user clicking on this and then going to this page or coming back and they were just here 5 minutes ago, it's more likely they're looking for X or Y. So beyond just saying, beyond just the like, hey, we support streaming features and stuff like that, what is the kind of like the featureization of a session look like in your world? And has that been a focus, or do you kind of just leave that to your users?
There has been initiative. So that's part of like data platform, which manages the event pipelines. So there has been a lot of initiatives around them to make all the events, but the source of the data more reliable, tested, and validated so that they can claim these are X sources which are tested by us and you can trust them. And then people can use those sources to create different features. And we have a lot of applications where we need this kind of streaming aggregations.
Yeah.
Like one of the major use cases we are now working on is managing fraud on our platform. And the things which we need to manage for this, like whether this user like purchased $1,000 of but products in like last minute or
last, yeah, whatever. Like last 5 minutes, how many transactions did they make? And if it's 1,000, something's weird, right?
Yeah.
That's interesting. And are you looking at more sophisticated ways to turn this sequence data that is the session events into features?
We have a lot of initiatives around it. Right now, the way we do it is we use Slink.
Yeah.
We started exploring Spark streaming as well. We are also thinking of building our own domain-specific language for defining those competitions. So there has, right now we are using Flink dominantly, but there are different initiatives going on to improve that feature engineering on real-time events. That's also part of this, making it self-serviceable so that user can easily hit the pipeline, like how they want to compute the feature on this real-time events. So that initiative is also going on here.
Okay.
There's definitely opportunity there.
We got to wrap up, but I got one last question, and I feel like it's only fitting right now because you mentioned that one of your key takeaways that you were thinking about for this conversation is something you wanted to hit home, and it's buying third-party products requires careful evaluation and integration with the platform to provide great user experience. And I figured it's only fitting since we got Mike on this call. What would you school Mike about for that experience? What are some things that we need to keep in mind when going through that from the engineer side and then from also the vendor side?
Yeah, I think one thing I think about like very normally, like there are a lot of open source ML platform out there, right? But still companies have to build their custom things internally. If you think about this fact, there must be some missing pieces. For us, it was not very easy for us to interpret, like integrate those things into our platform. Some of the things might be overhead, or some of the things has dependency on a big infrastructure requirement like Kubernetes. So all those things makes a lot of difference. And then some platform out there couldn't even meet our requirement, like latency or cost and things like that. So when we start introducing, like we had to go through a lot of deep evaluations of this platform where we used to integrate this platform into our toolset, run real application in it to figure out whether this will work for us or not. And most of the time, we find out that it's going to create more first user experience from like for user, especially for machine learning engineers. Like if we say we use XYZ technologies, then you get overwhelmed very quickly if you don't provide proper interfaces in front of it. And it takes time to provide or integrate this platform completely into a system so that we have a centralized logging, we have a centralized UI, we have all these centralized metrics, things like that. So that has been a challenge, and we still use a lot of open source tools, which works. And with this initiative of creating like a centralized web application and UI, we are trying to make the user experience less overwhelming as well.
So just to clarify, did you mean like when there is a system that, say, vendor or open source that you're considering bringing on board, integrate? Typically, there's a variety of dependencies that they have. Say it's Kubernetes, like DynamoDB, whatever. And it sounded like you were saying an important detail of those platforms is how modular or swappable those dependencies are. So maybe you don't, you know, maybe you guys don't use Dynamo, you use Redis. So can the same platform plug into the data infrastructure that you or other infrastructure that you already have, rather than requiring you to change some of your underlying data infrastructure elements? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that hits a point. Like for example, like even if we use Kafka or Snowflake, we don't want to introduce a new solution which will require us to like build the whole infrastructure just to use it with Snowflake. Like, that kind of overhead is big for small teams like us in the company, where we only have few people, so we can only And we have a lot of support requests and features we want to release. So providing like those flexibility to extend this open source tools or managed solutions to different technologies is like key to us.
Cool. Solid answer. Well, Sahil, thanks for sharing this all, man. This is
so good.
It's really cool because so many people are going through the same journey of adopting real-time ML. Yeah. And if I look at the blog post that you put together, it's very data focused. It's like, this is how we solve the data side of this, because that's the challenge when you move to real time. Sure. And that's one of the focuses that's what I'm spending a lot of time on. And I'm seeing a lot of patterns and how people are going through the same journey again and again. So thank you for sharing all of this.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I didn't even realize it's all almost one hour. So I had like great conversation and time just flying.
Goes like that, man. That's what we hope for.
This is Skyler. I lead machine learning at Health Rhythms. If you want to stay on top of everything happening in MLOps, subscribe to this podcast now. 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 Now.